You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to SS Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 26th of June, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Of course, I'm joined by my co-host from not Aryan Spring, Devonshire Fascist, he is now. Of course, I'm talking about Subal. Subal, how are you doing today?
I'm all right, thank you very much. Please, everybody, go and subscribe to my channel. Sven Longshanks tells me that thousands of people listen to this radio show, so if you're just stop the show right now and go and subscribe to my channel and help me beat the YouTube algorithm. Thank you.
Yeah, we do. I'm always surprised at the amount of listeners that we do get, really. And when you think it's about 25% British and I guess about 75% American. So depending which show it is, we must have 500 to 1,000 listeners in Britain, which is, you know, that's really good. If only we could see all of them at meetings and protests, then we'd have a really good movement going there. And talking of meetings, there's one which I'd like to advertise for next week, the John Tyndall Memorial Meeting, which is on next Saturday, and that's been organised by Max Musson. They've got a fantastic lineup. They've got Peter Rushton from Heritage and Destiny. They've got Eddie Morrison from the National Front. Dr. Andrew Emerson, Richard Edmonds, longtime nationalist. They've got Mark Cullett, who's just written a book, and he's also on the David Duke show. They've got Alison Shablow there. She's going to be playing, singing, performing a few tunes. Steve Frost from the British Movement. He's always an excellent speaker. Of course, there's going to be Max Musson speaking as well, and others. They've got a really nice venue. They've put a lot of work into this. They've got proper backdrops. It's the speakers are all going to be filmed. It was hoped that they were going to be doing this last year, but some other events got in the way of it, and Max was unable to arrange it last year. So it's happening this year. It's happening next weekend. So please do go and support this meeting. I went to the John Tyndall Memorial Meeting the year before last, and it was fantastic. You know, there were loads of people there, loads of stalls. That was actually where I met Jez Turner and various others, people that I'd watched online before and always been impressed by them and really wanted to meet these people and talk to them and thank them and shake them by the hand. And that's the way to do it, is when you hear about these publicly advertised meetings like this one, is to get in touch, go along, meet these people, and then they can see that you're all right, and then you'll get invited to the demonstrations and the other meetings and all the rest of it. So it's very important that we do have public meetings like this, and there are only one or two a year, and there's only going to be two this year, and this is the one this summer, so please get along there to it. I'll put an advert for this in the article, and I'm also advertising it over there at Radio Aryan. Have you ever been to the John Tyndall Memorial Meeting, Subal? I don't think I've seen you there, have I?
No. I've only been involved in the movement for a year and a half, 2 years. So
it's mainly the forums you go to, isn't it? Yeah, John Tyndall, I expect most of our listeners know, but John Tyndall was he started up the British National Party. He was in the National Front for a while. And he was part of the World Union of National Socialists and spearhead at the time with Colin Jordan. And when George Lincoln Rockwell came over from America to Britain, it was John Tyndall and Colin Jordan's organization that he was hooking up with. They had this big camp where George Lincoln Rockwell was smuggled in. He was smuggled in through Ireland, and then he was at this campsite speaking, and there was loads of publicity. The newspapers went absolutely wild over it, and he's really our main nationalist figure. And this memorial meeting is held once a year, And it's not just people talking about John Tyndall. It's about his legacy and where nationalism moves onwards from his time. What we can take from what he said and what he wrote, and how we can expand upon that, and how the movement can evolve. So it's just encouraging people to go along to it. Your Devonshire fascist channel, Subar. I hear you're picking fights with the Cornishmen. How's that going? Have any responded?
Yeah, I'm picking fights with everybody. Well, look, I have a plan. I mean, we talked about this last week. Basically, after that guy from Millwall, that working class hero, after he punched that terrorist and attacked that terrorist, I decided that I wanted to tap into not just national pride, but local pride, county pride, even your hometown or your home city pride. And that's why I've renamed my channel Devonshire Fascist. And it is my plan, basically, to attack and humiliate everybody in England until they get off their lazy bums and they start a YouTube channel for their own county, basically. So I want to see a Cornish YouTube channel. I want to see a Somerset YouTube channel. I want to see a Dorset. I want all of them. And all the cities, Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham. It's my belief that white nationalists in general should stand up and represent their part of the country. And, it's just peer pressure. That's all it is. Peer pressure works. Big surprise. Big surprise there. So, I don't know. It's only me by myself so far. But it's a long campaign, and my intention is to pick a fight with everybody in the entire country and insult everybody in the entire country until some people get angry enough that they actually go on YouTube to, answer me back and tell me what a twat I am, basically.
start making their own channels. Well, no, I think it's a good idea. I mean, people are always interested in their local area, what's going on in their local area. And YouTube itself is a really good way to reach out to people. If you think you go on a demonstration and the people that are in town that day that are doing the shopping, they see you, but that's not that many. And probably only 5 or 10% are interested in what you've got to talk about, if that. Whereas if it's on YouTube, then you're easily going to get a few hundred views, maybe a few thousand views if it really takes off. And people that are in your area, and if they look up their area on YouTube, that your video is going to appear to them. It means you've got a much wider reach of audience to speak to and convince of our ideas and that our way is right. I mean, if you look at someone like Tommy Robinson, he's having fantastic success with his channel and with his Twitter. And the internet is a great way to reach out to people, and we can change the way that they think. Just while they're at home. So hopefully we will see more of these regional channels.
It's kind of like just clickbait. I mean, let's say, for example, I do a video saying white men from Glasgow, are a bunch of pathetic losers, right? And I put that on YouTube. I could pretty much guarantee that you'll get a bunch of Scottish men watching it and going, well, hang on a minute, what's this guy saying? And I've already had a few replies to my Cornish video. I've got some Irish guy, which I had an interesting conversation with. So it's just clickbait, it's baiting, it's poking the bear, it's a slap in the face. You know, there's one thing that I've learned in life that, you can compliment people and they don't listen, but you give them a slap in the face and they never forget you.
And when you mentioned an Irishman there, I've had a request to actually talk about the National Party in Ireland, who are a really good nationalist party. If you check out their channel, they're excellent. They've got their main speaker, I think, is Justin Barrett. And he doesn't mention National Socialism, but it is National Socialism that he's talking about. The state has to be an ethno state. And he's talking about the rate of foreign immigration that's going into Ireland at the moment, how quickly they're being replaced. They think they're going to be replaced even faster than South Africa. They're in a really bad way at the moment. And these meetings that they've recorded, they've got lots of people there, lots of people, and he's got real gusto with the way that he speaks. Very, very charismatic speaker. I'd like to see some longer videos of theirs, because they're all sort of 2 minutes long, 5 minutes long. It would be good to hear a proper half-hour speech from him. But he does look like a very inspiring character, somebody that a movement could form around. You have to have these characters, people like Jez Turner, that a movement can form around. It's no good just having the ideas and the technical know-how. You've got to have that certain gift of being able to talk to people. Now, that gift that Adolf Hitler had to inspire the millions of people around him. And this Justin Barrett guy, he definitely seems an inspirational character. I'd like to hear more from them. And I did say that I would give a shout out to them. I've got a list.
The speech is definitely the most important thing. And Hitler himself said this in Mein Kampf. He said it's the word. It's not enough to have the written word. It's not enough. You have to go to a meeting and you have to actually hear the person speak and feel the atmosphere and feel the power and the potency of their words enter into you and change you. It's a divine and spiritual thing, really. I mean, if you hear a person's voice, it's the closest you can get to actually getting in touch with who and what that person really is all about. And this is why Donald Trump conquered America, because he traveled all the way around America doing rallies, sometimes two or three rallies a day. And it's because of the power and the intensity of those rallies and the atmosphere and the energy that was created that it just spread all over everywhere and conquered everything. And it's a crucial point to remember. And this is why UKIP has failed. They've got Nigel Farage, charismatic speaker, okay, but they don't do rallies. They don't have rallies. I would have gone to a UKIP rally if they had a decent one nearby. They don't do rallies. So they've got no atmosphere. They've got no feeling of togetherness. And they got no buzz. And so they failed. And I don't know why they don't do the rallies. I mean, I assume it's because they're afraid of terrorist attack or something like that. But that's just cowardice, basically. And it was actually on the Trump campaign. I was actually thinking to myself, because there are these rumors, isn't it, that Trump used to read Mein Kampf and it's on the side of his bed. And God knows if it's true or not. Well, I doubt we'll ever find out. But it was one of the things that made me hope, you know, because he did seem to be following that example to the letter. It seems that he understood that principle very, very well, that you need to have the big, powerful political rally. You need to see your leader and need to actually physically hear him speak. So, yeah, it's good.
Well, hopefully Amory Waters is going to take over at the helm of UKIP, and we might see some more promising things from them. She is a woman, but she does very well. Even though she is a woman, I think she does very well. I've checked out some of her speeches recently. But it's interesting that you bring up Trump there, because one of the things I've been thinking about just recently is how Jeremy Corbyn seems to be the mirror image of Donald Trump and what happened in America with Trump. I mean, Trump totally galvanized all these people at these rallies when he was campaigning. And Jeremy Corbyn seems to have done the same over here in Britain. Just on Saturday afternoon, he was at Glastonbury Festival, talking to Glastonbury Festival from the main stage. I mean, you're talking tens of thousands of people listening to him. I mean, he could never dream of getting to a rally that big anywhere else. And Michael Eavis just gave this audience to him. And they were all chanting his name and they're all wearing his t-shirt saying, they're not pretending anymore that this is that Glastonbury is about free speech or it's about letting everybody have a say. No, it's totally communist. And Jeremy Corbyn is their man. And we're seeing all these Jeremy Corbyn memes, people singing these Jeremy Corbyn songs. It does very much remind me of how Donald Trump became a figure for the alt-right. And Jeremy Corbyn seems to be this similar mirror image figure of Donald Trump. But over here in Britain, at this Glastonbury Festival, they also had Tom Watkins walking around, Ed Balls, Yvette Cooper. I mean, half the Labour Party were there at this festival. Jeremy Corbyn was pulling pints for people, being a real sort of man of the people. The BBC have completely changed their attitude. They're now right behind Jeremy Corbyn and they keep attacking Theresa May. And this is a real about turn for the BBC because they've never really supported Corbyn at all. But now they seem to be massively supporting him. And it just seems to me as if he is leading this alternative leftist movement. And that's because he does have the character. He does feel genuine, even though he's wrong in a lot of what he says. You do get the feeling that he genuinely believes it. And a lot of what he was saying at Glastonbury was anti-Trump. It was talking about Trump building walls instead of bridges. And he's conveniently forgetting that we now have walls on our bridges in London to protect us from these terrorists. And he's also talking about how we must not have any borders and allow all these refugees in, all this crazy stuff. And yet, you know, there's 100,000 people there at Glastonbury cheering the guy on. It's the complete opposite of what we saw in America. But it's down to the character. It's down to Jeremy Corbyn's character more than his politics, I think, because he believes in it.
I think that the Jews have basically realized that they can't. In the beginning, they wanted to get rid of him because obviously he's, you know, a little bit anti-Israel, and some white nationalists for some moronic reason have decided to support him because every now and again he'll make a vague comment about Israel. But, you know, guess what? What's he going to do? Is he going to start rounding the Jews up and put them in concentration camps? I don't think so. So the Jews have supported, nationalistic, parties and even Nazi parties in Eastern Europe in order to, get their agenda pushed through. So, they've decided to back him now. They've stopped trying to fight him. They did try to get rid of him and replace him with a Blairite type figure. And they've given up now. And now they're going to try to use Corbyn basically to smash Brexit. And, the whole media is just going full on soft Brexit. That is why Theresa May had the election. There was no need, no reason for her to have the election. She already had a huge majority, which David Cameron had won. Why did David Cameron win that majority? He won that majority because he promised to give people a referendum on Brexit. And also secondarily, because people were fed up with, stupid left-wing economics. For those two reasons, he won a massive majority. There was no reason for Theresa May to hold an election, but she held it anyway. Why? Because she planned to throw it away. She sabotaged her own election by not campaigning, by saying she was going to take money away from pensioners. And she almost gave the whole country away to Labour. But, we just managed to just about save it. We have this interesting situation now with Northern Ireland. But basically, everybody in the media and in the political realm is saying that the mandate for a hard Brexit has been lost, and now we're just going to push for a soft Brexit and some kind of they're trying to push some kind of coalition or something. I just saw in the newspaper this morning that what's his name, Justin Welby, I think his name is, the Archbishop of Canterbury, he's entered into the political realm now. And he's saying that there should be some kind of coalition government to bring us, you know, through Brexit, which just means, you know, more soft Brexit. And what does soft Brexit mean? So soft Brexit means continued open border, continued EU regulations. You know, it just means no Brexit, basically. That's what happens. That's what happens when you give the people a referendum and they vote the wrong way.
Well, he's always been political. I was talking about this on Truth Without Radio with Dennis about how a lot of his sermons, he's literally preaching from the UN Declaration of Human Rights and bringing up passages from that.
Justin Welby.
Justin Welby, yeah, the Archbishop. Okay. I mean, he's a total lefty, so that doesn't surprise me. But I even though the BBC is pushing for this soft Brexit, I don't think that's what we're going to get, because the Labour Party and the Conservative Party both agreed that we had to come out of the customs union and we had to come out of the single market, which is what the BBC are calling hard Brexit. But that's actually what the European Union is. I mean, we were told that the European Union wasn't a political union. What it was a single market, and then they changed it to customs as well, and then they made it a political union. So all of those things have got to go. When people say vote to leave the European Union, they're voting to leave all three of those. So there was no deceiving the public on that. And the Labour Party and the Conservative Party both agreed to leave the single market and leave the customs union, which will mean that we will be able to guard our own borders again. We will be able to say who comes into the country and who doesn't. But the BBC and the rest of the media are still going to be pushing for what they call a soft Brexit. I mean, they even attacked Andrea Leadsom over the weekend. She was being interviewed. Now, Andrea Leadsom was put forward as one of the puppets as a contender to be prime minister against Theresa May. And she said something about Theresa May not being a mother, so she wasn't really suitable to be prime minister. And it was all a big stitch up because Andrea Leadsom just didn't have the experience to be a prime minister anyway. But she was being interviewed over the weekend, and she said that it would really help if journalists were a little bit more patriotic. I mean, quite an innocent thing to say. And you would expect that a corporation called the British Broadcasting Corporation would be patriotic, would be talking about things that are in Britain's interest. I mean, it's got British right there in the first word in the title. So she said that the journalists should be more patriotic, and she got really attacked for this. And Tim Farron attacked her. She's been called a racist. She's been called all these names just for saying that people should be patriotic. I mean, and what is patriotic? I mean, it's standing up for your own people and for your own country and for your own land. And yet we've got these traitors that are in power, traitors in government, traitors in the media, that would rather shill for other people's interests than talk about our own interests. And you can see this with these recent incidents that have been happening in the news with this Grenfell Tower. I mean, what a fuss they made over that. And it was all foreigners in this tower. They had a day of rage afterwards, whereas we've been told to not look back in anger when a lot of white kids got massacred in Manchester with a nail bomb. We were told not to look back in anger. And yet after this Grenfell Tower, where a refugee burned the place down, they had this day of rage. And the media is all supporting this. And, oh, how terrible it is. You've got Jeremy Corbyn pretending to be in tears over this. And, you know, it's all forgotten about this terrorism. And then in the same week, we've got the white guy that mistakenly drives over a load of Muslims for whatever reason. Either he'd had too much to drink or he'd had too many depression pills or whatever, runs a few Muslims over. Oh, that's terrible. That's the worst thing ever. And it's put up there along with these genuine terrorist attacks when this guy wasn't political. He wasn't a member of any political group. He wasn't trying to pursue any political ideology. In fact, he was radicalized by the BBC. He said he watched a BBC program on the Pakistani grooming gangs, and that made him angry at Muslims. So he ran them over. So he's literally radicalized by the BBC. But they're pushing this as being the worst thing ever, the absolute worst thing ever, that one Muslim died. That was all. And he was dying anyway. He was being given first aid. And because of this day of rage, because of all this fuss that they made about this Grenfell Tower, they've now removed, I think, 800 people from these other towers. And they've been told they've got to get out from where they're living. They are absolutely furious at that, and I can imagine they really are enraged at that one, being told to move out. But they've only got themselves to blame for going out and making this big fuss about what happened with the Grenfell Tower. There's something else I wanted to say about this, but I'll pass it over to you while I think about that, Subal.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say about the Grenfell Tower, they've really set an awful precedent now, because basically they're giving a message to all the Muslims in the country, all these poor, Grenfell Tower was just a warren of subletted illegal immigrants, basically. That's why there are so many people in there. That's why we don't even know how many people die, because nobody even knows. Probably all their bodies just got melted anyway. But you've basically set a precedent. You've basically told these people now that if you set fire to your building and burn it down, the government will give you loads and loads of money and sympathy and will make you a citizen of this country and will give you a nicer, better place to live. That's what they're telling people now. That's why, you know, all this sympathy and all the charity, the stupendous amount of charity that's been heaped on these people's heads. You're basically giving a message to every poor Muslim in the country saying, burn down your tower block and we'll rehouse you somewhere even nicer. So, I don't know. I think we may see a few more fires in years and months to come.
Last night, we actually saw one yesterday. Another block of flats went up. But I just don't understand their actual logic and their line of thinking. I mean, if I lived in a block of flats and somebody that lived next door to me set fire to their flat and it burned through mine, I would then look for somewhere else to live. I wouldn't be expecting the government to rehouse me, and I certainly wouldn't be blaming the government. I wouldn't be blaming Theresa May for my next door neighbour setting his flat on fire. And that's essentially what this Grenfell Tower lot have been doing. Theresa May goes to visit them and they're all booing her and they're all accusing her. It's all Theresa May's fault that the block of flats burnt down. I mean,
ungrateful.
Where does this leap of logic come from that it's Theresa May's fault?
Yeah, they're just ungrateful scum. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I don't like socialism in general and even one of my criticisms of national socialism. Sorry, guys. But because what socialism does, and we do live in a socialist country. Of course, if you have a country where you have a welfare state and state education and state healthcare and all these things that we have, we're basically following almost all of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto in this country. In a country like that, you have, what you do is you develop in people absolutely no love or respect for charity. People have no respect or love for it because people, because they're paying taxes to the government and then the government is giving them the charity. They think, well, we deserve this. We earned this. We pay taxes and some of them don't pay taxes. But what you do is you engender a mindset that, you deserve this, the state benefits and the free house and all the blah, 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 blah. And you end up with people screaming and shouting, give me more, give me more, give me more, with no respect at all. Now, previously, before you had this kind of socialist country, people would still receive charity. They'd still receive charity, but they'd get it from the church or they'd get it from rich people themselves directly or from perhaps other kind organizations. But there would be a mood of gratitude. Like if you went to a soup kitchen or something like this, and they're helping people, there'd be a mood of gratitude. Oh, thank you. You helped me. And I mean, it's a two-way thing as well. It's not just the people receiving the charity that would be more humble, but the people giving the charity would actually have an opportunity to give. This in the society that we've built today, this socialist society, there's no real opportunity to give charity because you see poor people and you think, well, you know, the government will look after them, or, well, you know, I've paid my taxes, the government will look after them. So you basically destroy the principle of charity. You destroy the humility and the gratitude of the receiver, and you destroy the goodwill of the person that gives the charity. And what you end up with is an incredibly insolent and ungrateful underclass, which just screams more, 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 and just has no bloody respect for anything, really.
Well, they just assume they're entitled to all of this, don't they? I mean, what they've effectively done, they've changed charity from being a verb into a noun. Instead of an act of charity, you have a charity, which is a business, which is run like a business, like a corporation, whereas charity is an act of mercy to the people that you see around you. You help people out, the people that are around you, and it's not to be expected. So they've effectively done away with one of the what it actually means to be human is to is to give mercy and to give charity is part of what it means to be human. So they've done away with that. They've corporatized it and turned it into businesses that hand out money to people, hand out things to people, and people just feel entitled to it. And a lot of these people at this Grenfell Tower, I mean, half of them don't even speak English. Only about 1% of them were white. And they were saying, how can this happen in this day and age? How can this happen in 2017? How can they let this happen to us? They just expect to be cared for, taken care of, everything done for them, which is, as I say, when the roof caves in, they blame the government for this, and they expect the government to put everything right for them. They feel entitled to have everything done for them by the government. Whereas anybody else, a white man who lived in his own home, if it burnt down, he would be doing all he could to sort it out for himself. He certainly wouldn't be expecting the government to do it or blaming the government for this. It's taken away all sense of responsibility from people, so that they haven't got a chance to actually experience what it is to be a responsible adult human being. They're all treated like children, which is why I think it's poetic justice that they want to be treated like children. They want to complain and blame the government for the block of flats burning down. Well, okay, then all these other blocks of flats that have got flammable cladding, you're going to have to move out from them and stay in a hall on a mattress, which is what they've done. I think it was at least 800 people have been moved out from these other towers and told they've got to move out straight away, and they've got to stay on mattresses in a big hall. And it's in Camden as well, a real centre of multiculturalism and diversity. Happened right Camden. In the middle of Camden. But it really serves them right. If they want to be treated like children, treat them like children.
Camden's such a horrible place. I'm sorry. I went there just to, you know, diverge, but I went there like 10 or 15 years ago, and it was still kind of cool. You know, you had all these cool little, now hipster type, of course that's before hipsters, but you know, there was a lot of white people there doing cool, interesting stuff with their funny haircuts and all totally degenerate. But you could, I do have a certain appreciation for the hippie entrepreneurial mood of, I want to have my own business, kind of do my own thing, kind of, and also a certain level of craftsmanship. You know, they make their own t-shirts and bags and things and then sell them. I have a certain level of respect for that. And I went there a couple of years ago, and it's just full of flipping Indians just selling tat. It's a minor effect of multiculturalism, but there you go. I mean, the Indians, they've got no creativity, and what do they end up doing? Just selling flipping recycled tie-dye t-shirts. But anyway, yeah, I do agree. A man, he basically has a choice. I don't really believe in the kind of extreme individualistic Lone Ranger type, American type, you know, you've got your ranch and you stand on your own 2 feet kind of thing. I don't, that's a very extreme form of individualism, but I do believe a man has a choice. He can either choose to depend on his family and on his community, or he can choose to depend on the government. And when you have a socialist country like we do today, basically the government is going to look after you. And what that means is that people, they no longer have to try to make bonds of friendship with their uncles, their aunties, their cousins, their brothers, their sisters, their extended family, the guy that lives down the road, right? The next door neighbor, the people that run the shops in your hometown or whatever. You don't have to get on with these people. You don't have to try. Why? Because you know the government's going to look after you. So you just end up being acting like a spoiled teenager, basically. I mean, you can be nice enough. Hello, you all right? But there's no real effort to form a deep sense of community or a deep sense of bond with family or community. Why? Because it's not necessary. And human beings are, well, you know, we're lazy. I mean, if we don't have to do it, then why bother doing it, right? If you know the government's going to give you a place to live and give you a check and protect you, then why bother trying to form relationships with friends and family. So it, yeah, socialism, basically, it destroys the family. That's why I don't like it. Obviously, you know, before I get a bunch of people screaming at me, obviously national socialism is better than international socialism. And obviously, yes, you should have a love of the nation and a love of the people. But, this is why I changed the name of my, YouTube channel to Devonshire Fascist. It's because I believe that there is a order, if you like, a hierarchy. First of all, you've got to look after yourself. If you can't look after yourself, then you're just going to be a parasite on other people. So that's first. Second, you look after your family. After that, extended family, and friends, and local community. And then after that, your nation. You see, this is the order in which I see people place, they should have their loyalty. And I think, you know, nationalism in general, they kind of jump over the first few steps and they demand that people sacrifice themselves for their nation, which is all very noble. But the problem is that not many people are noble. That's why you have so many people joining the white nationalist movement. And if you want to get more people to join white nationalism, you're going to have to appeal to their lower instincts. You're going to have to appeal to their lower selfishness. You can have to appeal to them and their family and their local community. And you have to say to them, look, you join us or you follow our philosophy and you will be better and your family will be safer and richer. And your local community will be safer and richer and better. And then after that, the nation. So, yeah, that's the way I see things. I'm not a socialist. I am fundamentally a feudalist. And I believe in localism.
Yeah, it's family, community, nation, and then race in order of importance. I think the problem is these people have all got a sense of entitlement, but there's no sense of duty with that, no sense of responsibility with that. They all know what their rights are, they all know what their human rights are, but they don't have any duties, do they? They don't have any human duties, human responsibilities. They just demand their human rights, and that's because their socialism looks at people as economic units. And that we're all the same economic units. We're all created equal and we're all expected to generate a certain amount of profit or currency for the economy, regardless of anything else. That's what we're just looked at. And if we did have a sense of duty and a sense of responsibility, it would be to our ancestors. And that's the people who built the country. And we can't have anyone having a sense of loyalty to the ancestors because that's racist. Because that means that you associate yourself with the people of the past, and you cannot, by definition, then associate the newcomers with the people of the past. So they don't want to do that. So they can't possibly have a sense of duty and responsibility in the people in our country, because that would, by necessity, mean excluding any newcomers. Mm. So that's another part of it as well. And everywhere you look at it, this whole idea of racism being wrong, the idea that putting your own people first is wrong, is at the root of so many evils that we have to contend with. It amazes me that the way that people are so shocked by the word and so don't want to be called a racist, when it's the most natural thing in the world. And when we lose our sense of racism, when we lose our sense of responsibility and duty to our ancestors and the people that come after us, then we lose everything, which is what's happening now, which is why we have the third world over here that think that they are entitled to everything, because they think that all human beings anywhere are entitled to everything all at once. And if they don't have it in their third world country and we have it in our first world country, the only reason we've got that is because we've taken it from them. We can't possibly have got it because our ancestors scrimped and saved and sacrificed to build it for us, because we're all equal. Otherwise, they would have it over there in their third world country. So this is the logic that comes about from rejecting racism and rejecting nationalism. And this is this socialist ideology, which doesn't work. The only socialist ideology that does work is the national socialist one, which is only for the nation. And I know you think that it encourages people to rely on the state for things, but with National Socialism, I mean, the state provided jobs for everyone. So people were still providing for themselves because 99% of the country was put back to work, and they had a big increase in their wages, and they were working to build roads and infrastructure and new houses. And new families would get 25% off the price of a house for every new child that they had. So even though it was everybody looking after one another, it, when it is kept within that one specific ethnicity, then it does work. And I think that is a kind of feudalism, because you still had the hierarchy. You still had the one guy at the top. You had the Führer at the top, who is like the king, like the monarch, who can, you know, he's the one who is responsible. If everything goes wrong, he can be held accountable for that. When you have democracy, socialist democracy, you can't hold anyone accountable because they're gone within 5 years. And you can just blame the guy that was there before you for everything that goes wrong. If you have proper national socialism with the Führer principle, you've got somebody that's prepared to take the responsibility for their actions. Because it's not just all the proles that don't take responsibility, that have rejected the idea of having duty and responsibility. It's all the politicians as well. The whole of democracy encourages people to have no sense of responsibility to the past, no sense of responsibility to the future and the future generations, and just to take everything that you possibly can now. And you're even encouraged to do that when you're voting. People today are encouraged to vote for the party that is going to do the most for them, not what's going to be doing the best for the nation, but who's going to do the best for them. And this whole Labour Party is built on that, offering people what they're going to give them and what they're going to take from somebody else to give to them. The whole system's rotten right at the very core, isn't it?
Yeah, it's dumb, and it just creates infants. I mean, we are living in a state of arrested development. People don't use that word very often, but I do like it. We're living in I've got a few friends actually who told me that they basically made a decision in their heads that they never wanted to grow up, right? And I haven't talked to these guys in a few years, but they kind of like they just watch cartoons and play video games, and they're absorbed in that kind of nerdy type culture, you know, science fiction type culture, fantasy type culture. And they made a deliberate decision in their minds that they don't want to think about politics. They don't want to engage with it at all. They don't want to grow up. They idolize childhood and the innocence of childhood. And they basically refuse to face deal with reality. Like, what the hell is going on in the political realm around them? They just switch it off. And it's something, again, which is very much encouraged by socialism, because there's this idea that, you know, you're just living in a nanny state and nanny's going to look after you. So you could just suck your thumb and play video games and masturbate while, you know, the Muslims pour in and rape our women. And if somebody horrible like me, because I do have a tendency to prod people, somebody horrible like me starts prodding them, saying, oh, hang on a minute, look what's happening. They just go, oh, yeah. Oh, you're so angry. I just want to punch you in the face. You know, it's a teenage childlike mentality, and it affects men all into their 20s, into their 30s. I mean, it's just pathetic. It's just so spineless. It's really disappointing and crippling. And I don't know. There's many different aspects to this mindset, but it's actually one of the most interesting things about socialism is the paradox that it creates individual atomized units. You know, it's so egalitarian, it's so for everybody, that you just sink down into this muddy slush, and you just become as a unit, you know, just a human resource, a number, and you don't care about anybody except yourself. You just become totally selfish. And yeah, that's what we've got today.
Cut off from everyone else. I'd just like to go back to where you were talking there about people getting lost in the fantasy world, you know, science fiction, the computer games, the films. And you can even go back to novels and fantasy stories. They're all substitutes for our genuine myths and our genuine classics that we've had with the classic storylines that are based on true events, that things that happened and are myths. I mean, they never had fantasy novels 2,000 years ago. They were writing about their history and their genealogies and our history. And when you do get into the myths and the gods and the goddesses, they're all talking about archetypes and things that lie deep within our psyche. And we've given all that up. And for a substitute for that, we now create the worlds of Doctor Who or Star Trek or Star Wars. And it's all complete fantasy and it's all complete gibberish. Whereas what we had before, we had thousands of years of crafting a storyline that would help us to understand more about ourselves. It wasn't about fantasy. It wasn't about getting yourself lost in some fantasy world, which is just, you know, it's coming to its fruition now with computer games where people can literally get lost in a three-dimensional fantasy world. But it's all hiding away from the real world, and it's all a substitute for this knowledge and wisdom that our ancestors passed down to us, because they were able to, through this gift of writing, being able to pass down information from one generation to the next. It didn't all have to be oral. I mean, this is one of the reasons why we have such a huge difference between white people and Negroes. Negroes never invented writing, so they were never able to pass down all the knowledge from the previous generation. All they could do was speak to one another with a very limited language that they had anyway. Whereas we could pass down this knowledge and this information from one generation to the next. And that's what it was used for. And it was the priests and the scribes and the very top people that could write. And it was almost like magic, that people could read this information and they could tell you things which you never knew before. And look at what we use it for today. Fantasy. To escape from the hideous world that we've allowed to be created around us. You have to break free of it. I mean, I'm talking from experience. I used to be really into all the sci-fi, fantasy, all of that.
Oh, I used to love it.
And it's just a substitute for myth and religion.
Yeah, and it's actually a classic socialist meme, if you like. I mean, if you look at the two of the most famous socialist pieces of propaganda, you have the Martin Luther King speech, and he starts off and he says, "I have a dream," right? And then you have the John Lennon, "Imagine a Future." I mean, that is socialism. That is the left wing. Instead of looking at the past, you destroy the past. You have a year zero, right? You burn all the books, take down the monuments, and you look to the future. You dream about the future. You fantasize about the future. And you have a complete lack of respect and a complete disrespect for your ancestors. You just don't care. It's this idea that history is boring. You know, this is another theme which they like to shove down your throat all the time, isn't it? Like when at school they say, "Oh, the most boring subject is history." I actually thought history was quite interesting when I was at school. It's like one of my favorite subjects. I remember being at school. I remember everybody. There's this idea that history is the most boring subject. History is the most boring subject. It's kind of like as a people, we've stopped looking backwards and we've just turned around and started looking forwards instead. And it's all of this happened, I think, pretty much around about the same time that this theory of evolution was developed, because that's kind of when you had science fiction starting, and when people started developing theories that, you know, mankind was created by aliens and things like this. But pretty much around about the same time that theory became popular, people started dreaming about spaceships and future cities and the technology. And it's like almost like the transhumanist idea was already mixed in inside the evolution idea. And it's this basic philosophy that Somewhere back in the past, we were, single-celled organisms, and then we evolved into fish, and then we somehow or another we evolved, from fish to land-walking animals. Somehow or other, animals evolved wings. I don't know exactly how you evolve a wing, or whether you get like stumps on the side of your body one day, and somehow that helps you reproduce, and then slowly, a wing develops. But it's this idea that we are evolving and progressing into the future. I think evolution is a fundamentally progressive idea. It's an ideology which states that you have the survival of the fittest. There is no morality, only survival. And just by tooth and claw, by blood and hacking, somehow or other, you scrape and you fight and you tear your way into some kind of future. And this is what the left wing, this is what all these flipping transsexuals are thinking. They're thinking we are the next evolved state of man. We are the transsexual beige utopia. And if you have to, break a few omelets, if you have to break a few eggs to create that omelet, if you have to, create an ocean of dead bodies in order to reach that utopia, then so be it, right? That is the law of nature. That is the law of survival of the fittest. We will progress. We will progress into the future. So yeah, futurism and science fiction and evolution, they're all tied together and even tied in really with the scientific revolution, which was really the real changing point. 1620, Francis Bacon started the scientific revolution. And it's just, it's a rejection of the past. It's a rejection of our ancestors. This is why I actually have a lot of time and patience for pagans, even though a lot of them are extremely disrespectful and annoying, because I do believe that these gods, these Norse gods and these Greek gods, I believe that they are actually our ancestors. So there was a man at some time and his name was Zeus or something like Zeus. And he had children and his children, respected and honored him as an ancestor. And over time he became, a godlike figure. He was deified. This is what the Romans did with some of their emperors. So it's my belief that Zeus and Odin and Thor and all these people, they are actually great ancient kings that have been turned into gods. So I've got a lot of time for pagans because of that. And, we've forgotten our history. That's why we have to take a little bit of time to read Virgil, read the Aeneid, read the Iliad, read Homer, read these ancient books. And, I've got to say, I honestly feel it's a spiritual experience. It's a calming and soothing spiritual experience to read these books. It actually there's a lot of hippy dippy jargon about all kinds of, hippie experiences you can have smoking marijuana and things like that. But, I would say that, I'm only halfway through the Aeneid, but I would say, it's just such a beautiful, beautiful book and it's really inspiring. So,
it's our heritage, isn't it? That's the thing. It's our heritage. Yeah. So you can read it today and you're still going to be able to understand it because it was exactly the same people as we are today that wrote that 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. And this is what I understand from reading the religious texts. I mean, it's the same people. That's why they're writing about these things. That's why there is that connection, because it's our people. It wasn't meant for all the rest of the world to read. They don't have a connection with it. Mestizos don't have a connection with the Greek classics. You could say that the Indians do have a connection to the Vedas, even though they were written by white people. But that's because the Indians are partially descended from the people that wrote the Vedas. But that's the only reason why there is a connection there, I think. If you can read Greek classics today and you can understand it just as well as the Greeks did 2,000 years ago and understand the feelings that they had and why they were doing the things that they were doing. And those books, every story that you're going to read today, every fantasy story, every novel, there's going to be nothing in those that wasn't already covered in these adventures that the early Greeks had, the early Phoenicians, the early Norse people. And I agree with you about pagans and this impulse, because what it is, it's an impulse to learn about your ancestors and learn about your traditions. But it comes, a lot of the time, unfortunately, it comes out in an anti-Christian negative way, because I think the Jews like to push this idea that drive a wedge between white people and drive a wedge between pagans and Christians. Never mind the fact that both pagans and Christians were white. They were exactly the same people. They just had one idea at one time in our history and another idea at another time in our history. That's the only difference. They weren't different people warring against one another. It was one and the same people. But the idea and the impulse of going back to that and studying it and learning it, and it's the same impulse that drives you to read these Greek classics. And that's why people feel drawn to it, is because it was our beliefs back then. I mean, it fascinates me. Learning all about our history fascinates me. I really don't like to divide it into pagan and Christian. I mean, there's pre-Christian and Christian and post-Christian today, but all that time we still remained the white race, split up into the various different breeds of the white race, the different nations that we have in Europe. And it doesn't matter if you're from a different nation, you can still understand the myths from another white nation, because we are all white, because we all are one family. This is why we can read the Vedas, we can read the Greek stuff. It may not be Greek, may not be Aryan Hindus, but we can still understand it, because it was created by the white race for the white race, and we feel that connection with it, and we feel inspired by that. And you're gonna get so much more out of reading classics or reading religious texts than you're ever gonna get out of reading a modern day novel, science fiction novel, or playing a computer game. I just think you're playing a computer game. I mean, that's the hours that is spent doing that. If you were reading religious texts, you would be getting insight that stayed with you for the rest of your life. All you're going to get from a computer game is, oh, I got to the final level. Wow.
Yeah.
How does that cause you to evolve and progress as a white man? It doesn't. It's masturbation. Yeah. That's all it is. It's masturbation. Just purely for self-gratification rather than self-evolution, I think.
Yeah, it does seem like entertainment is becoming much more hedonistic and dumbed down. For instance, in the past, maybe you'd watch a film or a television program or something like this. But these days, people what they do is they go out and buy a box set and they just binge. You know, they'll just spend a whole weekend or a whole week when they're not working, or if they work at all, you know, just watching an entire series, you know, of like 3, 4, 5, 6 seasons of a particular show, and they'll just get totally absorbed in it, and it'll be very low quality drama. The only reason that they actually watch it and enjoy it is because what happens is they develop a familiarity with the characters, and they start to feel like those characters are their friends. You see, that's how soap operas work, because the brain can't tell the difference between you know, real life and fantasy. So they just, yeah, they'll watch 20 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours of some flipping box set of some series and just totally, totally dive into it. It's the same with video games. Video games take, some of them take 40 or 50 hours to complete. And it's not a high level of skill either. I've actually got quite a bit of respect for old school arcade games. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I used to go to the amusement arcade and play these stupid games, and it was kind of like there was a skill to it, you know. And you had like the older boys, they'd come in the amusement arcade and they'd just have like 20p, you know, and they'd put 20p in and they'd be standing there playing for like, you know, an hour, and then they'd complete the game on only 20p, you know. And it took some really intense concentration and skill and practice and ability to do it. It was like da 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 boom. But nowadays video games are extremely low level, you know, when it comes to skill. Arcade games, yeah, there's some skill involved. Video games today are just supposed to be total immersion. Like these sandbox games, Grand Theft Auto, you're just driving around the place like an idiot, you know? Just driving around in your fantasy computer world, no real skill involved, just driving around, la la la, wasting time. I mean, it's awful. It really is.
It's a waste. Yeah. We're talking about the media and science fiction and these films that are all fantasy. At least now we can create our own content, which is what we're doing here with these podcasts, what you're doing with your channel, Subal. I mean, people would be far better off getting a box set of SS Britannia and listening to them. I know people do it with Grandpa Lampshade's podcasts, go right back to the beginning, and Triple Outrader. Wow. You'll get more from that than sitting there in front of the Gogglebox. Anyway, we've come to the end of the hour, Subal, so I'll say thank you very much for coming on.
Cheers.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget John Tyndall Memorial Meeting at the weekend. Check out Western Spring for details on that, and there are also details on that at Radio Arium. You can also donate to us to our Bitcoin wallet, and we also recommend that you donate to Morgos Review as well. We'll be back next Monday, same time, same place on Radio Arium. So until then, have a great week, and God be with you.
Arian for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArian.com.